Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. What is literary archaeology? Well, about two years ago, I had no idea what literary archaeology was. And I have to share a story with you how this term was actually created. Some of you have already heard the story, so they'll hear it again, and they can compare the two versions of the story. In Israel, I don't drive, so I'm being driven, and I take long cab rides all over the country, giving lectures here and there. And whenever I take a cab ride, you know, the cab driver give me his political tractate, and cab drivers love it, love to share their politics with you. And I don't necessarily love their politics, but after half an hour when they finish giving you their political shtick, they move on to personal questions. What do you do for a living? And I always made the mistake of telling them, well, I'm a biblical scholar. And that was a mistake, because then the next question, how come you don't wear yarmulke? How come you're a biblical scholar? And then I have to apologize to a cab driver. So I really didn't like the idea. So one time we were driving to the Negev, to the Egyptian border, to give a lecture there. And the cab driver asked me, what do you do for a living? And then I was so smart, and I said, wow, I'm a literary archaeologist. Quiet, silence, nothing. He didn't ask any more questions until we got to the place. And then I had a lot of time to think to myself, what did I mean by saying that I'm a literary archaeologist? And then actually when we got there, I had already an idea. What is the difference between literary archaeology and real archaeology? So first of all, literary archaeologists never get dirty. We sit in an air-conditioned office. We enjoy ourselves. We have our cup of coffee. We can think. We can write. We can read. Great pleasure. Number two, the more important difference, of course, is that real archaeologists, when they want to reach some ancient strata, they have to dig deeper and deeper, while we literary archaeologists actually can find ancient traditions in later, younger strata of our literature. How come? When the Bible was written, when people sat down to write the traditions that were transmitted orally from generation to generation, they didn't want to write the traditions the way they knew it. They knew them. They wanted to change them. They wanted these traditions to meet their own standards of religion, of morality, etc. So they had to change slightly the traditions. Sometimes they had to totally reject the traditions they knew. But again, it's very difficult to kill a good story. And stories that have not been included in the Bible or stories that have been changed, you know, have not been lost. People kept, you know, transmitting them from generation to generation until at some point when these stories were not threatening anymore, they were written down by later generations, either in some Second Temple period composition, like pseudo-apocryphal book or pseudepigraphal book, or later on in rabbinic literature, or even much later. And we are always there to look into this later strata of our literature, to look for the older traditions there. So that's what literary archaeology is all about. And if you haven't understood yet, which I can understand, we'll try to understand it while we actually get and read the examples we have here on our sheets, and I hope you all have the handout so we can start working immediately. Now we're going to work. Don't look at me, look at the texts now. So the story we are going to refer to now, oh my God, some people here don't have handouts, including my boss.
Everybody took my handout.
Yeah. Okay, so I hope that all five of you can share one. I'll actually give you another one, but you'll give it back to me.
Okay.
You got one. Okay, fine. So the story we are going actually to read together is the famous story from the book of Joshua about Joshua stopping the sun and the moon. Joshua was fighting the Canaanites. The day was too short. You know, in those days they didn't have all the equipment that your sophisticated army has in Iraq, you know, that they can fight only also nighttime. So they had to stop the war nighttime. They had to go to sleep and to continue only in the morning. So, but Joshua actually called God, and God stopped the sun and the moon for him, and they could go on fighting for 24 hours. So that's the story, the way we have it in the Bible. But if we look at Joshua, yeah, and then they all returned to Gilgal. And then those five kings fled and hid in a cave in Machpelah, in Makeda. What's going on here? Where is this verse about Joshua, together with all Israel, returned to the camp of Gilgal? Where is this verse borrowed from? You know, there is no perfect crime. Remember it. It's so very important to remember. If that's the only lesson you remember from tonight, so please. Because here I know exactly where these verses about God fighting for Israel and the verse that follows about them going back to the camp in Gilgal, I know exactly where it's borrowed from. Because if you look under number 2, which is the end of this very same chapter, chapter 10, that the end of Joshua fighting all the enemies in southern Israel. And there we read, all those kings and their lands were conquered by Joshua at a single stroke. For the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. Then Joshua with all Israel returned to the camp of Gilgal. Here it belongs. It belongs to the end of the chapter. Here it's necessary to have it. But the person who wanted to actually to emphasize that it was God who fought for Israel took this verse from the end of the chapter, introduced it into our scene, but he was not careful enough and took with it another verse, the verse about going back to the camp of Gilgal, which is totally out of place in the middle of the chapter. But now we understand. So the original, the biblical story is about God fighting for Israel, making Joshua, you know, a human. Well, God did listen to him, but nothing more than that. But here we have other pieces of evidence which help us to reconstruct the ancient tradition. And the first text we have here, text number 3, is from Ben Sira. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the book of Ben Sira. If you're not familiar with it, go home tonight, read it. It's a great book. It will put you to sleep immediately. It's a book that hasn't been included in our Bible, but it is in the Christian Bible. It's actually in the Septuagint, already in the Septuagint, the Bible of the Jewish community of Alexandria. And the reason it didn't make it into our Bible, because we knew who wrote it. If you want your book to be included in the Bible, never tell that you wrote it. Because the moment you know who the person... Well, how can you put in the Bible, you know, a book written by your neighbor? It's impossible. So since we know it's Ben Sira, our neighbor, we didn't include it. But it's a great book of wisdom, like the book of Proverbs. It's even more Jewish than the book of Proverbs, because that's the book that identifies wisdom with Torah. And at the end of this, so for many, many years, by the way, we didn't have the Hebrew original of the book. We had just the Greek translation, which is very tough to read. But then, 100 years ago, a miracle, the Cairo Geniza was discovered, and there we find some manuscripts of Ben Sira. About a little more than 50 years, we discovered Qumran and all its scrolls, and also there in Qumran, in Metzada, we found bits and pieces again from Ben Sira. Now we have a Hebrew copy of Ben Sira, which is really great to read. Anyway, towards the very end of Ben Sira is doing like a Misha Beirach to all the great heroes of Israel, from the heroes of Genesis to the heroes of his own days in the second century BCE. And when he gets to Joshua, that's what he says about Joshua. When he fought the battles of the Lord, was it not at his same hand the sun stopped? Actually, was it not with his own hand that the sun stopped? Meaning, Ben Sira is telling you that Joshua just lifted his hand and the sun stopped, so that one day became like two. Well, you see, Ben Sira is preserving for us the more original tradition about Joshua himself stopping the sun. And something interesting, when you read, if you go back to paragraph number 1, why not? Paragraph number 1 telling us about stopping both the sun and the moon. And I would like to read you again one verse when Joshua actually is addressing the luminaries and telling them to stop. Stand still, O sun at Gibeon, O moon in the valley of Ayalon. knowing the rules of biblical poetry, I can understand this verse in two different ways. One way, stand still, O sun at Gibeon, and you, moon, stand still in the valley of Ayalon. Meaning, I take the verb from the first half, move it, and actually use it also in the second half of the verse. On the other hand, it's possible, and it's totally legitimate, believe me. I can read it, stand still, O sun at Gibeon, and you, moon, can do whatever you want in the valley of Ayalon. You can still move. And that's even a greater miracle, because it's like a watch that has two hands. One hand stops, and the other hand keeps moving. So that makes it a real miracle. And actually, if you keep reading this paragraph, you see that on the one hand, verse 13 is telling us that the sun stood still and the moon halted, both of them stopped. But then if you keep reading the verse, getting to the second half of verse 13, thus the sun halted in mid-heaven and did not press on to set for a whole day. Here we stress, here we emphasize that the sun stopped and we don't care that much about the moon. Actually, the moon is of no interest to us. What's important for us is that the sun stopped, so there was enough light on the battlefield so they could keep fighting the war. And I emphasize the fact that stopping the sun is much more significant for us than stopping the moon, that actually stopping the moon, it's insignificant, because you see already what Ben Sira does. Ben Sira mentions the sun being stopped, does not refer at all to the moon being stopped. And if I look at later, rabbinic sources, I see that again and again, they refer to the sun being stopped and don't even mention anything about the moon. For instance, you have here number 4 from the Babylonian Talmud tractate Sukkah 28a. Our rabbis have taught Hillel the elder had 80 disciples, 30 of whom were worthy of the divine spirit resting upon them, as it did upon Moses, our master. 30 of whom were worthy that the sun should stand still for them, as it did for Joshua, the son of Nun. And the remaining 20 were ordinary. But you see that the mid-30, yeah, that they actually were worthy that the sun should actually stand still for them. Nothing is being said about the moon. And again, a quotation under number 5 from Midrash Tehillim, the Midrash on the book of Psalms. And the sun stood still for Moses 2 times. First, when he fought with Amalek, and second, in the war of Sihon and Og. That's something that's not mentioned in the Bible at all. But you know, there is a competition between Moses and Joshua. Joshua is just the disciple. And such a great miracle is attributed to him that he stopped the sun. Can it be that he is capable of stopping the sun and his master Moses is not? So the rabbis are telling you everything that Joshua can do, Moses can do better than him. If Joshua stopped the sun once, Moses stopped it twice. You know, when I read this tradition in Midrash Tehillim, and I'm familiar with this tradition already for many, many years, you know, I smile the way you smile now. Ha ha ha, the rabbis invented this tradition. So very nice. But then, you see under number 6, 4Q357A26, well, it's a tiny little fragment from a scroll found in Qumran, which the scholars gave the name Joshua Apocryphon. And when I first read it, I saw that actually it was misunderstood. It's actually a paragraph written there about Moses, not about Joshua, about Moses. And of course, like most scrolls, half of the scroll was eaten by mice. So, but we like it very much when scrolls are being eaten by mice, because then we can come with our theories and there is nobody to deny it, you know. So anyway, great deeds, meaning Moses performed great deeds, great miracles, and he stopped the sun. Moses stopped the sun in a scroll from Qumran, which is so very great, because this way it's not a tradition invented by the rabbis, by finding it in this scroll, I actually take it back already to like the 2nd century BCE. It's a pretty old tradition, which is very nice, of course. But now I'll skip number 7. We'll get now to number 8. And here is something very important. Look, we have this tradition, and we know it now from Ben Sira, and we know that the rabbis want to tell it also about Moses, that Joshua actually is the one who stopped the sun. But that's all we have. But now, if we get back and read now number 8, number 9, number 10, we'll see that there is a special relationship between Joshua and the sun, and that there were some authorities that actually wanted to deny it or to hide it from us. But again, since there is no perfect crime, we are able to discover this tradition there. So in Joshua number 8, Joshua 19, verses 49 and 50, we read, "Then when they had finished allotting the land by its boundaries, the Israelites gave a portion in their midst to Joshua, son of Nun." That's like the American tradition. When a president resigns or ends his term, he gets a library, like the Nixon library you have in Orange County, etc. So they gave a piece of land to Joshua, son of Nun. At the command of the Lord, they gave him the town that he asked for, Timnath Serach, in the hill country of Ephraim. He fortified the town and settled in it. So what? So he got a city, and the name of the city is Timnath Serach. Can you do anything with this name? Nothing. Neither can I. Okay. So why did I bring this paragraph? I have no idea. So let's move on. We'll see. Perhaps something will come up. But now we can move on to a number 9. And that's a verse, that's a paragraph about the death of Joshua. After this event, Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. They buried him on his own property, again, at Timnath Serach, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. So what? Again, nothing. I don't get anything out of it. But now, let's wait for number 10. Because in number 10, in the book of Judges now, the beginning of the book of Judges actually repeats the verses that we have just read in Joshua chapter 24 with a slight difference. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years and was buried on his own property at Timnath Heres. Not Timnath Serach, but Timnath Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. What's Heres? Heres is another word for the sun. Yeah, Heres is another, well, we know the word Shemesh, which is the more popular one, but of course the word Heres, like we have it in the book of Judges, we have it in the book of Job, it's in the book of Job, Ha'omer l'Heres velo Yizrach, who says to the sun that won't rise, for instance. Or in the book of Judges, chapter 14, we have a story about Samson that the people of Timnatha actually solved his riddle. He actually gave them 7 days to solve his riddle. And at the very 7th day, right before sunset, they solved his riddle. Beterem yavo hacharsa. Again, the word for Shemesh there is Heres. So now we see that there is a special relationship between Joshua and the sun. He gets this city, which is named after the sun, Timnath Heres. He dies there. He is buried there. But you see that in the book of Joshua, they tried to hide it. They tried to blur it. What did they do? They took the word Heres and changed the order of the letters. The third one is first, the second is in its place, and the first is last, of course. So they totally changed the order of letters, and they thought that they were so successful and that they could mislead us all. But there is no perfect crime. What happened here? How come we have the more original version in the book of Judges? Let me explain. That's the rule of center and periphery. What's the rule of center and periphery? I'm sure you have all read the great Soviet encyclopedia. of course. I haven't. But anyway, so in the great... But that's a well-known story that, you know, in the great Soviet encyclopedia, they kept changing history. Like every day, according to the winds, the political winds, you know, there in Moscow, they rewrote and rewrote. For instance, the entry Stalin was written many, many times. So, of course, if you get into the, if you got still under the Soviet regime, into the Lenin Library in Moscow, of course, there you got the very last edition of the entry Stalin. But if you took a train ride to Kazakhstan, to Afghanistan, or to any other stan, the mail didn't make it there, the librarian was fired, etc. So there you still see the entry Stalin from the 50s, the original one. And that's, so that's the law of center and periphery. And what we have here is exactly the same thing. In the book, where do you look for information about Joshua? In the book of Joshua, of course. You don't look for information about Joshua in the book of Judges. So they actually changed what they had to change in the book of Joshua. They didn't bother. They didn't think that we'll look for information about Joshua in the book of Judges. And there we find the original version, again showing us that there was a special relationship between Joshua and the sun. Joshua, who stopped the sun, lives in a city and is buried in a place that carries the name of the sun. Now, something very important. You know, Rashi, the most famous Jewish medieval commentator, whom we never suspect, you know, of being interested in preserving mythological traditions for us. He's the last person you would have expected to do something like that. But then you read Rashi's commentary on Joshua chapter 24, verse 30, and it's clear that Rashi here preserves an old midrash, but many midrashim have been lost. Midrashim are not the Bible, so people didn't always preserve them. Many of them have been lost. Many of them are quoted in later books, and that's an example. Rashi, who preserves for us a lot of midrashic traditions, preserves here a beautiful midrashic tradition concerning Joshua. And in another place, meaning in Joshua, in Judges chapter 2, because that's a commentary on Joshua chapter 24, but Rashi knows, of course, Joshua chapter 2. So, and in another place, he calls the place Timnat Cheres, because an image of the sun was erected on his grave, to say, this is the one who stopped the sun. By the way, in Hebrew, the name of the place is Timnat Cheres, Timna. And you have a word play from Timna and Temuna. Temuna, a picture, an image. So an image of the sun, Timnat Cheres, was actually erected on his grave to say, this is the one who stopped the sun. And everybody who passes by his grave says, oy vey, pity for him. Oy vey is not in the original version. Pity for him who did such a great deed and died. Because, and why do we have this last sentence, pity for him who did such a great deed and died? Because if you look around, if you shop around, and you go to Akkadian traditions on the one hand, or look into Greek traditions on the other hand, you see that people who are capable of doing things like that, and they are capable of doing it, they are heroes who stop the sun all over the around the Middle East. Of course, these people who stop the sun for doing something like that, you immediately get promoted and get tenure in heaven, meaning you become a god. If you are capable of stopping the sun, you become a god. Not in Israel. Since in Israel we can't tolerate anybody to challenge God, anybody to become another God, so of course the person dies like any other human being, and that's why Rashi says, pity for him who did such a great deed and yet died like any other human being. Look, people in Israel, in ancient Israel, were indeed very sensitive when it came to the sun deity, and the stories related to that. For instance, under number 12, before, okay, don't look at number 12 yet, I have to tell you a story first. So you are all familiar with the story of the last judge of Israel, Samson, Shimshon in Hebrew, whose name is related, of course, to the sun, Shemesh, Shimshon. And when Shimshon is born in Judges chapter 13, and again, his birth story, very suspicious what's going on there when the angel comes to the wife when she's alone and tells her that she's going to give birth, but I'm not going to get into it right now. But anyway, then the baby Samson is born, and usually when babies are born and they get their names, we get an explanation of the name. Why was the name given? We know why Jacob was named Jacob, why Moses was named Moses, why Isaac was named Isaac, but when he gets to Samson, quiet. Nothing is being said because it's very sensitive. It's clear that the name is related to the son. But it's actually a bad policy not to get to say anything, because then it invites, you know, we can come up with our own explanations, and that's dangerous. So the rabbis, who were aware of the fact that it's very, very dangerous, what do they do? And that's again number 12 quotation from the Babylonian Talmud tractate Sotah 10a. Samson was called by the name of the Holy One, blessed be He. As it is said in Psalm 84, for the Lord God is a sun and a shield. So as if he has nothing to do with the sun deity, since the rabbis found a verse, and they always find a verse if they need one, where the sun is a metaphor for God. So then, of course, Samson is named after God, and everything is fine. But, of course, if you think about it, the territory in which Samson was so very active, that's the territory of Beit Shemesh, the house of the sun anyway. So, but they did try. Now you have another story with which I'm going to end, about a different period, a much later period, a miracle performed by the prophet Isaiah. King Hezekiah was sick. He prayed to God. He didn't want to die for some reason. And God promised him 15 more years of life. But Hezekiah was a tough cookie. He wanted God to prove it to him that he's actually letting him live for 15 more years. So he actually got a sign by God that he is going to stay alive. And what is the sign? And there are two versions of this story in the book of, one in the book of Kings, actually the more original one, and the second one in the book of Isaiah. And again, I'll read you the one in the book of Isaiah, which is in a way, again, the periphery, because the biography of Hezekiah, the place to tell the biography of King Hezekiah is the book of Kings. And in the book of Kings, you read the story and you see there are strange things going on there. But listen what's happening when we read the version of Isaiah. And this is a sign for you, says Isaiah to King Hezekiah, from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that he has promised. I am going to make the shadow on the steps which has descended on the dial of Ahaz. The dial is the sundial of Ahaz. Because of the sun, we see 10 steps. And the sun receded 10 steps, the same steps as it has descended. So here the sun doesn't only stop, but the sun is actually even going backwards. It's even a bigger miracle. But again, when you read the more original version of this story in the book of Kings, the word sun is not there at all. Only in the secondary version in the book of Isaiah, you find a piece of evidence that such a miracle actually took place. So you understand how sensitive this whole thing of stopping the sun, of a man being capable of stopping the sun, how sensitive this issue was. The Bible tried its best to hide it from us, but we have our tools. We look into a Second Temple literature like Ben Sira. We look into rabbinic literature, later literature. We look into parallel traditions, you know, within the Bible, like the one about Isaiah stopping the sun. We look into ancient Near Eastern material, and this way we are capable of doing the work of a literary archaeologist. reconstructing traditions that have been rejected by the original writers of the Bible. Thank you very much.